Thank you for coming. So, Carlotta, I'll hand over to you now.
Okay, and I'm Carlotta. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Liz, for your very kind introduction. So, basically, as I would like to start by providing you a little bit of background, let's say, and contextual information on this research, because as Liz said, I come to this topic not as a practitioner, but as a bit of an outsider, so as an international relation theorist, really. And what I'm interested in and what I normally study is why countries decide to participate and to comply with international security regimes. So what are the drivers that push states to basically implement? So this is just a basic overview of what this presentation is going to consist of. And my research has been focused so far on what I call the multilateral counter-terrorist regime, which is basically a sum of agreements that are both formal and informal that were developed before and after 9/11 in order to, if you want, harmonize counter-terrorism fight worldwide. And I focus on three specific case studies. So I look at the fight against counter-radicalization, so the fight against, for example, homegrown terrorism. I look at the inclusion of human rights safeguards and due process safeguards within the remit of counterterrorism sanctions in the United Nations. And then look at counterterrorism financing. And how do I come to the FATF? So normally speaking, multilateral counterterrorism would be focused on the United Nations, and I will mention that a little bit shortly. But ever since October 2001, there have been a development within the FATF that has in a sense merged anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing within the recommendations of the institutions, and the United Nations has in a sense taken over the specific framework. So looking at the UN and looking at the FATF in a sense makes sense because the two cooperate in a specific respect. But in a sense when states implement, they look more at the FATF than they look at the United Nations. But as I said, what I'm interested in determining is once again why states comply, and whether participation in these regimes, in a sense, activates what I define as, structural conditions or even social incentives that push states to implement a specific agreement. As I said, my background is in IR. I look at sociological and also socio-psychological approaches on group pressure, and I basically refer to a phenomenon that I call social influence. So if you look at the theory on implementation, what you normally get is that states implement a certain agreement because it makes sense for them to do so. So you have a cost-benefit calculations, you try to basically maximize benefit and minimize cost, and states will implement if they establish that they can, for example, maximize a certain interest, for example, attract international investments, or they can establish a good reputation as a cooperator, and so they will, in future, reap the benefit of future cooperation. What I say is that this is very interesting. It certainly works for the FATF, as we will see, as a specific way of bringing and shaming nations into compliance. But according to my findings, this is not the whole of the picture. This is not the whole of the picture because I think the states, when it comes to the FATF, have become more concerned with how their international image, and in a sense, in a second, we'll distinguish what image and reputations are, can be affected by social processes of shaming internationally. So I call this process social influence, which differentiates from reputation because it's a maximization of a purely psychological payoff. So states are not necessarily just thinking about, I need to look good because otherwise I will not attract investments, otherwise I, for example, the city's own reputation will be in a sense, affected, but I need to look good because I need to look good. I need to look good because I need to participate and be part of that specific group of countries that are on a specific list and score in a specific way. And this is quite, not controversial in the literature, but is in a sense moving beyond evaluation that, if you want, are purely rational, to try to understand what are the drivers, emotional drivers, if you want, of state responses to particular, basically, international agreements. Just a word about my methods. I'm very interested in this specific audience because I normally present before international relations theorists, and obviously we speak the same kind of language. And so I have a slide on theory, which if you're interested in, I can show you, but it's at the very end, not to scare you. However, in terms of methods, so obviously I rely on any kind of documental evidence I could get my hands on, which means about 300,000 documents that I sifted through, and mostly also newspaper reports that kind of tend to give you, if you want, the temperature of the room, the kind of reaction the state had about, what kind of scoring they get on the mutual evaluation reports. But I also rely on some structured elite interviews with representatives from three different countries, specifically the United States, the UK, and Italy, from different agencies, so going from ministerial level to, for example, central banks, to the Treasury Department in the US, and also looking at different ranks. So for example, former Secretary of the Treasury, all the way down to bureaucrats and practitioners that actually implement the policies. So to see what kind of reactions that you have and if there was a difference between the different levels. So before I move on to the description, this is the only theory I'm going to give you, just to define. So I've been thinking, I've been talking about image, and what I mean by image is basically the general impression that a person, an organization, or a product presents to the public. States are concerned about their international image, I claim, but also their self-image, which is basically the idea that one has of its own abilities, appearance, and personality, and a notion that has a lot to do with the actor's perception of how they should be perceived by a stranger or by an outsider. So it's not just what they think they are, but how they think they want to be perceived by the others. And so, for example, if you think about honesty is a characteristic. So if you're talking in terms of image and basically self-image, we would refer to a state's willingness not to be seen as honest, not to be honest, but to be seen as honest, to be regarded as honest by others. So it's not the possession of the characteristic in itself, but how you are seen by another that is important. And shame, as I define it, is a feeling of self-reproach that arises when people notice a discrepancy between their thoughts, feelings, or behavior on the one hand, and important norms and expectations on the other. And what is interesting is that psychologists tend to relate shame to the fact of the presence of an audience. So if there is an audience which could be more real or imagined, there would be basically no shame. So image and shame, in a sense, from this specific perspective, are related. So obviously this is a very, informed audience. You don't need to be reminded of what the FATF is, but the Financial Action Task Force that was established in 1989. I'll go in detail into the process of establishment and creation, because this is what I'm interested in terms of the countries that participated and what they were actually trying to do. This is just a summary taken from the FATF's website of the 40 recommendations, for those who are not familiar with them. And starting from 2001, obviously, the 40 recommendations added the 9 special recommendation on counterterrorism financing. They basically mandate countries to ratify and implement counterterrorism financing instruments, going all the way down to basically monitoring cash carry financial activity for not-for-profit organizations. So it's they are considered, as you know, the state-of-the-art standards in a specific field. And they are largely implemented by countries. So FATF counts about 34 jurisdictions that are members, plus 2 non-regional organizations. So you have the European Commission and the Gulf Council. And according to the State Department, through FATF regional style bodies, the standards are actually implemented more or less in about 180 jurisdictions worldwide and reach about 100 countries. So you have about 34 members, but about 180 jurisdictions that actually refer to the FATF, which is, by international relations terms, or by international regime terms, pretty unprecedented, because normally international regimes don't tend to be quite so successful. So my question becomes, how do you explain such a, success of the FATF? Also, as I was mentioning, the regime has been highly embedded within the United Nations counterterrorism system. So it basically reproduces, I'm not sure if you're familiar, Resolution 1373 of 2001, which mandated that under Article 7 of the Charter, so legislated in counterterrorism financing worldwide. It has been incorporated with Resolution 1617 of 2005, which basically details the fight against terrorism financing in the sanctioning sector. It has been incorporated in Council of Europe resolutions, and it also part, obviously, of money laundering directives of the European Union. So it's a very well-spread system, as I said, relatively successful. So how to explain success from my point of view? I consider the FATF a specific pedagogic institution, and I attribute to the FATF what I define as a sort of educational, mission, that I explain looking at so-called FATF model in 3 different areas. So on the one hand, you have what we call a standard process of norm setting that revolves around the 40+9 recommendations. And the purpose, taken from the Charter, is to foster a collegiate environment, a forum of goodwill where colleagues meet, become acquainted, and hopefully eventually assist one another, even meetings and workshops, which provide venues where members share experiences and ideas, offer advice, and learn from their respective successes and mistakes. So this, in international relations speech, becomes what we call socialization. So basically the induction of new members, if you want, into the practices, the styles of a given community. And this is a very standard process of socialization that is typical of the fact of agreeing to something we apply, for example, to NATO very clearly. How does it do that? Well, there is a durable training of security actors and financial elites. So they use, you know, interpreted notes, international best practices that are circulated, typology exercises, and also through the IMF and the World Bank, model laws, or for example, common law, civil law legislations. The second aspect of the FATA, which is very interesting, is the compliant verification system, which obviously some of you will be very familiar with, which is characterized by what Gardner calls graduated peer pressure system. So once again, through self-reporting mechanism, which normally are on a yearly basis, but if countries get promoted, they can, for example, report on a biannual basis. And then the so-called mutual evaluation reports, which obviously, as I said, most of you will be familiar with, that basically are produced by three or four experts after country visits every set number of years. So there have been three rounds of evaluation reports so far, and there is one round that is currently ongoing, that started in February 2014. Countries are very sensitive to the specific, to the outcome of the evaluation reports. As we know, countries can be rated along four different indicators. So you go from being fully compliant, to being largely compliant, to being partially compliant, to being non-compliant. And countries that are members of the FATA need to be compliant or largely compliant with the majority of the recommendations. Otherwise, there will be sanctions. So the sanctioning mechanism is nothing material, but it's basically exercising different levels of peer pressure, naming and shaming on the specific countries. So you can start with basically a country that did not score very well on a certain number of indicators. And so you can be asked to submit a new report to the president of the FATF. If they've not seen that this is actually satisfactory, they will ask for a new country visit. And if this is not satisfactory again, they might inform, for example, financial institutions of the particular situation of the country. The utmost sanction is actually expulsion from actually the membership. And this is interesting because selective membership, membership of the FATF, as I've seen it, is a specific, a much coveted status, if you want, internationally. So if you access to the FATF, you actually have access to specific club goods. So there is, the membership process is two-pronged, and what is interesting is that it doesn't just look like, doesn't just look at the health of the financial system, but up to a certain extent, it also looks at the strategic importance of the financial jurisdiction and the country's overall interconnectedness with the multilateral, international multilateral forum. So there is a political component in it that, in a sense, is not clearly addressed, obviously, in the different recommendations. And how does this play out is very interesting, especially for countries that are not members of the FATF and, as you know, might have been listed by the FATF, the list of non-compliant countries. So if you look at Indonesia, for example, after 2002, after the Bali attacks, they did their utmost best to get basically taken out from the FATF blacklist because obviously this has some very material consequences on their financial system. And they managed to get that done, and then they were relisted again in 2012, in February 2012. And I think what is particularly interesting is looking at the reactions of the countries when this listing and delisting happens. So in the case of Indonesia, if you look at, for example, the press, I mean, the newspaper reports at the time, you get statements like, for example, well, the countries were stunned, for example, by the criticism. And then you get, as I said, statements like, well, the country has been betrayed. There is a feeling of being poorly rewarded for all the efforts that have been made under the anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing regime. And this works for countries that are non-cooperative, for example, Indonesia, but then works also in the case of countries that are cooperative or have better scores on FATF report cards, specifically the three ones I look at, so United States, the United Kingdom, and Italy. And I think those cases are interesting because normally you would focus on countries that tend not to comply with FATF's membership or FATF standards and then are pushed by the international community to comply. But what happens when you have countries that actually participated in setting up the regime and should be actually perfect according to given standards? So I call the US the regime setter because from an international relations perspective, starting in 1989, what the United States did with the FATF was basically export its criminal justice system worldwide and globalize what they perceived as the global war on drugs through the Financial Action Task Force. Obviously, the negotiation process was more complicated, and if you're interested, I can discuss about it. But I think that pretty much the position of the United States with respect to the FATF and to anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing standards can be summarized by these quotes, which it's attributed to Juan Zarate. At the time, it was the Department of the Treasury Assistant Secretary for Terrorism Financing and Financial Crimes. So what he says is basically, well, it is important to note a critical international trend as a result of our engagement in this issue. The international community has now begun to view the Bureau as the U.S. Treasury and others in the U.S. government have always seen it. And if you forward it, basically, this is how the new axiom of the international community, and it is so because the U.S. government has helped reshape the way the international community thinks about these issues. So a quote like this basically be interpreted as a clear example of export of U.S. as I said, criminal justice system at international level through the FATF. And this was institutionalized first in 1989 and secondly after 2001. So in terms of the US involvement with the specific process, obviously, I don't know how familiar you are with the US anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing system, but basically, in terms of its involvement internationally, there are three ways. So between 1989 and 1996, the U.S., as I said, contributed to setting up the regime and then tried to push for standards and reforms that were in line with its criminal law priorities. There is a very famous speech by President Clinton in 1995 at the General Assembly, where it was expected to deliver a talk on the future of the United Nations. And so they were expecting to talk about human security or poverty or the fight against HIV. And actually he took the stand and started talking about criminalizing the war on crime, and starting basically a new global program that would, in a sense, harmonize legislation worldwide along the wishes of the United States. And so there was a push by Treasury, especially after 1996, under the leadership of Lawrence Summers, to advocate, that was the word that he used, other countries and other legislations to comply with FATF standards, even countries that were actually obviously not members of the FATF. After, between 1996 and 2001, what happens at a macro level is that the United States normalizes the approach and in a sense merges counterterrorism financing and anti-money laundering legislation. Now, I'm not an expert, perhaps some in the audience can actually clarify this point for me, but I read that sometimes it is seen as a negative development, that it shouldn't have happened. So whether it is a positive or a negative development, I don't know, but this is the way the United States actually pushed for it between 1996 and 2001. Then obviously, after the Bush administration came into power in 2001, there was a move away from basically multilateral approaches to counterterrorism financing that were taken over again after 2001. And there are a series of very interesting, if you want, anecdotes on how offices were set up, then they were understaffed, and then they magically reappeared after 2011, and then they were transferred from Treasury to the CIA, and then they were abandoned, and then they reappear again. So the system was, in a sense, a bit sketchy, but what happened is that the U.S., with the help of the United Kingdom, pushed for a specific institutionalization of the provisions of Resolution 1373 at FATF level. So Resolution 1373 was adopted by the UN in September. In October, they started negotiations at the G8, basically by December, the new special recommendation had been adopted in the FATF, all of them besides the last one on cash carriers that was adopted in 2005. What is interesting is, how did the U.S. score on the specific mutual evaluation reports? Because this is what basically countries are interested in. So you would assume that it being the regime setter, the United States would have perfect scores or compliance, everything is perfect. However, this is not the case. And so what is interesting is looking at U.S. results on the different mutual evaluation reports and how they reacted to it and what they did with it. The first mutual evaluation report came out at the beginning of the 1990s, and countries' levels of compliance were considered generally commendable, but the countries was found wanting on about 50 issues in implementation of FATF's anti-money laundering provisions. To name just a few, for example, U.S. non-bank financial institutions were not uniformly subject to the full range of anti-money laundering requirements, particularly when it came to suspicious activity reports. The number of foreign crime priority offenses to which the U.S. standard laws applied was insufficient. There was a certain reluctance of U.S. enforcement agencies to use optimally suspicious activity reports to instigate investigations. and government agencies do not provide enough feedback to financial institutions on suspicious activity reports. Now, what I'm interested in is not so much what happened in terms of implementation, but what is the reaction of decision makers when this report is published. And it's an interesting backlash and an interesting, if you want, spillover effect from the financial purely to the political, because the backlash over the outcome of the peer review exercise had interesting political, repercussions, and it did not stop at the financial sector. So you started having countries basically going on the records and criticizing the United States as being the principal source of, for example, money laundering worldwide, but a country that had not been really criticized by the Fatah because it was a regime sector. You had diplomatic frictions between Washington, Israel, Moscow at the time, and Mexico, because the United States at the time was pushing for example, compliance with Fatah standards in this country, because they were on a sort of civilizing, educating mission by the Treasury Department. But here, Washington did not score, you know, a perfect role. At the same time, they were still pushing for the reform, and after 2001, obviously, they adopted the Patriot Act, which improves their system, and they try to export this system once again using the United Nations and the special recommendations. What happens is that they start negotiating within the Fatah, but the system is changing. So we tend to look at institutions and international relations as either agents or principal, in a sense. So either they are simple agents of the state, so they do what the states tell them to do. And so if the state loses interest in the institution will not work independently. Or they are quite what we call independent agencies, so they're able to act up to a certain extent beyond, if you want, the wishes of the specific countries that set it up. So it is interesting because if you look at the history of negotiations on the Fatah and on the specific resolutions and what the US was pushing, for example, in the year of charities, in the year of cash carriers, and so on and so forth, the US started not getting what it wanted, and the kind of outcome that it started obtaining was not exactly what it would have preferred. So the way you can interpret this is actually looking at the institution as acquiring, what we say, a life of its own, and Fatah's recommendation becoming basically what we say soft law and international relations. So being able, in a sense, to go well and beyond what the United States wanted for them. The interesting development or side development is this happened, and I can spot this across the whole counterterrorism regime multilaterally. And the consequence is that, I've seen this, but it has been spotted by other scholars, that basically the US lost interest in the process up to a certain extent. It happened with the counterterrorism committee at the United Nations, and according to some, it also happened up to a certain extent with the Fatah. So if you look at negotiations, for example, the beginning of 2001, the US tried to push for the Fatah to incorporate the recommendations. Then they started negotiating with the IMF and the World Bank to actually take the process away from the Fatah, the sanctioning process, and bring it under the remit of the IMF and the World Bank. Negotiations went on for about 1 or 2 years, and then the IMF and the World Bank basically did not agree, so participated in the process, but did not take it over. And how do you explain that? Because on the one hand, the US were using the Fatah, on the other hand, they were realizing they were losing control over the organization because delegations were becoming important within it. In terms of basically the specific reaction at the level of how US, for example, policymaker react to Fatah's evaluation. We have had 3 rounds of evaluation so far, so in the beginning of the 1990s, mid-1990s, and the last one for the US was in 2006. I think it's scheduled to be evaluated again next year, starting in March 2015. When the last evaluation came out, at the time, Daniel Glazer was the head of the US delegation at the Fatah. The US was criticized, for example, for basically non-compliance with recommendation number 5, so it came out as being partially compliant on beneficial ownership, which is particularly interesting. There was a storm coming from other countries, for example, countries that were presiding the Fatah at the time, accusing Washington of, you know, sidetracking the process, or, for example, using a shotgun approach because the US tended to combine, you know, sanctions with specific regulation. And once again, you have, interestingly, US representatives, so the ones that set up the system, coming out and say, oh, but criticism is not fair. Actually, we're doing all of this. And look, it is actually a difference in, you know, cultural approaches to a specific phenomenon, and we have already updated our system. So there is, in a sense, a parallel of what we hear from, you know, Indonesia. Criticism is not fair. We're doing everything we can, and so on and so forth. But here we have a country that is supposed to have, you know, set up the system. What is also interesting is that, as I said, the US was putting on, considered partially compliant with the recommendation number 5, and was given, I think, until 2008 to basically become fully compliant, which did not happen. I think one of the last laws that Obama was trying to push in the Senate before becoming president in May was the so-called Levin bill that was supposed to bring the US into full compliance, but it did not happen. So what kind of consequence does it have? I mean, this is from a quote from a Clinton administration official who used to work at the time in the Treasury Department. There is basically a credibility pressure on the country, obviously, to strengthen their anti-money laundering and counterterrorism financing provisions because the US has a hypocrisy problem. And so if the US has an hypocrisy problem at home, then obviously it cannot push for compliance worldwide. So we need to fill the holes in our framework. And what is also interesting is that they tend to sometimes refer to the Trump as the gospel of anti-money laundering legislation. And there has been a scholar, I forgot his name, there's a look at Fatah document, and sometimes you can actually spot messianic language in it. So it talks about, for example, the mission of the Financial Action Task Force. And this is kind of starting to sift through also in the reaction of the US administration. So if you talk to Treasury officials last year, they would say that everything they were doing was about, well, Financial Action Task Force and recommendation number 5. So everything was about beneficial ownership and resolving the issue of beneficial ownership. Because, to quote again, that this is actually a former Treasury, Secretary of the Treasury, countries are afraid of being singled out by the Fatah because people don't feel good about being singled out. This is interesting because I think this is not just a matter of reputation. I don't feel good because I'm not going to get, you know, the investments that I want. My country is going to lose points. This is something more, if you want, ideational, related to the identity of the country. So this is for the US. The UK, probably you know more about the UK than I do, but what I call the UK, and I'm interested in saying if you agree with it or not, is a carefully cultivated image of virtuosity. I will not go into the details of how the United Kingdom, you know, basically addresses the issue of anti-money laundering and terrorism financing, but what I spotted was a certain trend of being better than the best. So the UK contributed with the United States in setting up the system and with the Financial Action Task Force, and also in pushing for an incorporation of its basically recommendation within the UN system. So the UK, for example, sponsored Resolution 1373. It was in the United States. I found this quote. This is from 1997, so after the second, basically, mutual evaluation run, particularly interested from the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Britain was not content simply to be a bystander. Britain has had 150 years or more of being a leading player on the world economic stage. Our empire is gone, but it has left us with a genuine worldwide spread of economic interest and an economy which faces outward. And we have brought and continue to bring a distinctive British approach, a belief that is best to harness the power of markets for goods, a belief in pragmatism, bias against government, etc., etc. And in recent years, we have been working very closely with other countries to increase our efforts to tackle the threat posed by money laundering. So then it focuses on the role of the UK in the Fatah. Countries from every part of the world look to London for guidance on best practices in training, investigation, and law enforcement. And the Financial Action Task Force, an international body established under the auspices of the OECD, basically recognized the UK's prominence in this area and encouraged our countries to follow our example. So if you look at newspaper reports that come out, for example, at the same time that mutual evaluation reports come out, and if you look at the mutual evaluation reports from 1990 onwards, obviously in the last round, the United Kingdom was found partially compliant with, once again, beneficial ownership recommendation. The reaction, once again, is we're going beyond the standard. We're trying to address every possible situation. Obviously, especially in the middle of the 1990s, there were issues with the crown dependencies and how they were seen in terms of complying with public standards. But there is this idea that, in a sense, there is an excessive zeal, if you want, and extreme reactivity, once again, so the kind of language that is used is extremely emotional, which is interesting, to being singled out by the Fatah. So as I said, the UK in 2006, was partially compliant with recommendation number 5. And I think they managed to get promoted to biannual basically reporting in 2009, which is considered to be a very interesting and very good basically step. This becomes even clearer, I think, when you look at a country that I call a triple panic implementer, so Italy, I had the pleasure of being Italian, and I think that the case of Italy is interesting because if you look at, in a sense, the trajectory of the country within the FATF, so it was one of the founding members in 1989-1990, it got its first report in 1993, and the FATF recognized the schizophrenic power. So on the one hand, we have a fundamental problem with organized crime. We have a problem, perhaps, in political will, which was actually spotted in the report in terms of implementation and bureaucratic, basically, delays to implementation. But on the other hand, you have, in certain areas, actually, regulatory devices that are actually beyond the top of the standards. So, for example, there's a very sophisticated decalogue of best practices that is circulated by the Italian Central Bank and what is now the Intelligence Finance Unit, what used to be the Currency Exchange Bureau, that is considered to be very detailed and really state-of-the-art legislation. But then, obviously, in terms of implementation, what is interesting to notice is that you have, once again, this sort of waves waxing and waning, and when the regional evaluation report is coming close, and that's where countries will speed up, basically, their implementation efforts in order to meet the standards. Obviously, with Italy, for the first 15 years, it did not work. So when they had the last evaluation report, it was in 2000, and so they were visited in 2005, was one of the first countries. They were still trying to implement the second European directive, which was one European directive too late, because the third European directive had come into force. But since Parliament had cleared the previous one, they couldn't actually become compliant with the second one in 2005. When they did that, and they got the mutual evaluation report, the result was pretty much a disaster, in the sense that, let me see if I can find the actual quote. I think they got full compliance for only 11. They got was funding full compliance, sorry, 12 recommendations out of 49. And the country was based on the yearly follow-up process, meaning that it was downgraded from the biennial follow-up process, and we managed to recover only in February 2012. And the framework overall was found non-compliant in 14 instances, including with respect to all recommendations on designating of financial business and professions, and in relation to special counter-terrorist recommendation number 7, which is related to the identification threshold that at the time was 12,500 euros and was supposed to be 10,000 euros. And in 11 instances, the country's framework was only partially compliant. So what I did was seeking out central bank officials and Ministry of economy and finance officials, especially the ones that represent us on the FATF, and ask them, so how do you feel about this? And obviously, they started trying to explain to me what was the reason, like the structural reason behind this lagging behind in implementation, which was that Parliament wasn't coming to a specific agreement on, for example, updating our legislation, that our legislation was actually updated after they passed the mutual evaluation report in 4 months, which is unprecedented by Italian standards. And that actually they're now working, they started working 2 years ago, to be ready for the next round of implementation and evaluation, which is going to be in 2015. So this is particularly interesting. But I asked her, so why is it so bad if you didn't get very good grades? And one of the answers that I got, and I quoted, I guess, the one that I thought more interesting was this one. Well, we have to obtain good scores because we have to be placed on the whitelist. We have to be on the list of the civilized countries of the world. We have to do well because the assessments are published and countries make comparisons and look at each other and how they do. We have to align because this is what all virtuous countries of the world do. And after going on for this for about 20 minutes, that's when the official told me, and she's the representative of the FATF, oh, but obviously there will be economic consequences if we don't get the right scores, but this is why it is important. We have to be in that group. And then what was even more interesting in terms of, if you want, power dynamics within institutions is that they started discussing about the last round of FATF reform that came out in 2012. Italy, I think, was presiding at the time. And there were some tensions between the Anglo-Saxon camp, as they called it, and the civil law camp in terms of the detail of the standards or the overall approach to regulatory effort. And so I asked the specific official whether she thought that this sort of globalizing effort in the United States had been, and the United Kingdom has been particularly successful. And she replied that this is actually a collective effort. This is not something that was spearheaded by the UK or by the US. which, according to a US scholar, it's a sign of good hegemony because it's not perceived. But on the other hand, it is interesting because it means that other delegations within the Fatah do not, in a sense, recognize necessarily the predominance of the Anglo-Saxon camp, and they are pushing for standards that are not necessarily what, once again, the United States wanted at the very beginning. This is extremely interesting because it means that it's, in a sense, losing control of the process. So, to me, what does it mean in terms of, you know, what the Fatah does and how it is successful? Well, I think that what is interesting to remark, that there is now a particular value that is attached to Fatah standards that goes beyond, if you want, the specific area of regulation and, you know, of the financial sector, which is enhanced by the expertise of the members. So this is something that they recognize, that actually delegations have more leverage, the more experts and the more competent they are in a specific issue area. And that the fact that as, I mean, the recommendation has become what they call the crown jewels of soft law. So they've taken on this idea of, you know, having a life of its own that cannot be necessarily controlled by the countries that set up the system in the first place. Then I look at specific intra-group dynamics and negotiation within the institutions, and I'm triggered, yes, by public embarrassment and followed by predisposition of members to compare notes and scores with respect to a specific group of reference. So they look at the virtuous capitals of the world, the civilized nations of the world, and you get these scores over and over and over again. There are obviously intra-group disagreements right now, fundamental normative positions within the Fatah, so how flexible the standard should be, how detailed the standard should be, whether, you know, Anglo-Saxon legislations are really so comprehensive that they make themselves out to be. And then, in terms of outcome, what is interesting about this regime is that actually you do not only spot what we call on-paper compliance or mock compliance, which is what happened mostly with, you know, the majority of international regimes. So you have consistent patterns of justification, a lack of behavioral conformity, you have alignment with the task force standards, both at public and private sector levels, and also you have frequent instances of emotional reactivity to criticism of rewards. And I think what is most interesting is the lexicon that countries use. So if you ask practitioners, it talks about feelings of anger, embarrassment, hypocrisy, of not being good, perception of unfair treatment, of having to be part of a specific group or a specific list, the use of ideationally charged words like virtuous, civilized, whatever that means, pride, conscience, and pride. And I think this is interesting because it's not what you would expect from, you know, the Financial Action Task Force, in the sense that when you study this specific regime, which has been done obviously in the past, what they point out is the, you know, cost-benefit calculation, the rational approach to this specific implementation pattern. But it seems to me that, at least talking to this specific practitioner, it's going beyond that. And it's touching on really what a country thinks its role is in the world, its status, its position, its standing is in the world. So just to conclude, it's a quote from François de La Rochefoucauld, our mistakes are easily forgotten when they are known only to ourselves. I think that one of the successes of the Fatah is it's making its needs public, but also allowing countries to, in a sense, internalize the shame that comes from complying fully with anti-money laundering, terrorism financing. So thank you, and I actually look forward to a practitioner's perspective on this because, as I said, there is more theory if you want to be scared, but you can go back to it if you're interested, but I guess probably not.
Thanks, Carlotta. That was very, very interesting. Okay, can I ask Nick then to sort of comment and open the discussion for us?
Yeah, absolutely, and a really interesting presentation to get that sense of language from the officials who are closest to this implementation of FATF recommendations. Really helpful. Transparency International is an organisation that produces a lot of research, and quite a large amount of that research is aimed at shining a light under issues that perhaps it's convenient to ignore, and very much in a feature of bringing recognition to the issues, we hope that potentially either there's a feeling of pride in acting on those recommendations or potentially shame in not acting. So even for us, it's interesting to understand the effectiveness and limitations of the FATF approach. I wanted to talk about some specific issues that you've raised in your presentation. So there's this in law and in practice dimension to any standard, but particularly interesting for FATF, I think, because it's going through a process of change from being an in-law standard, which just marks compliance with the standards in law, to looking at effectiveness in practice. And that change is going on very currently, and that's something that the UK is responding to right now. And there's a lot of uncertainty about how that might work, and it'll be interesting to see the effects of that change on the credibility of the standard. I wanted to talk about a Swiss example, the overseas territories in the British overseas territories context, and compare perhaps with the UN Convention Against Corruption as a similar standard. So a Swiss example, relatively recently in a kind of 10-year time frame, there's been a growing public recognition about the harm and financial facilitation that was coming through Switzerland and the Swiss banking system's role in facilitating financial crime around the world. That public recognition having driven a lot of political change. So I think it's interesting to talk about not only the shame at the policymaker level, which in some constant context, as I think policymakers can be quite resilient against the shame if they don't take the assertion as credible. So what actors do the public officials listen to? And certainly the Swiss example, I think, is one where it was only when the public reaction within Switzerland was hostile to the issue, it drove shame at that policy level. I think in terms of that example and others, what's interesting to draw out perhaps is the different themes that are communicated around that shame and the different effectiveness that may have in different national contexts. So whether that's a crime, a law and order narrative, whether it's a terrorism and threat finance narrative against terrorist financing, whether it's an aid effectiveness narrative, which we've seen play out with certainly a UK debate and the different tensions in UK politics right now with on the right of the spectrum in the UK, and whether it's a national security issue, so affecting one's own country's foreign policy, independent foreign policy, which we've seen most recently with Russia and the UK. So which issues have the most resonance for shame, I think is an interesting one to pull out. In terms of the British Overseas Territories, I think that's an interesting set of issues to look at. I know we have colleagues with experience here. Part of the story of change is again that credibility of the standard and the buy-in from the policymakers and their constituencies that they think are most important into the credibility of the standard. And I think British Overseas Territories and Crown Dependencies are an interesting example because we've seen quite wide variation in response and enforcement of FATF recommendations among those group with broadly some similar characteristics in their economies and constitutional issues. Some particularly Crown Dependencies have been very effective at enforcing anti-money laundering recommendations. The other issue with the British Overseas Territories is the UK's own role. So not only internationally, but the UK has taken quite a normative approach, a moral language approach to putting out suggestions of that could be interpreted as something close to shame on the British Overseas Territories around its G8 presidency. So that interplay between the UK and the British Overseas Territories actually putting the UK in quite a vulnerable situation for shame. I think in your presentation you point out the reaction of the US under the first enforcement report of FATF, and perhaps most effective when a nation has taken that jump to commit itself to hold others to the account of the standard then they are most vulnerable to shame against one of those reports. I think that's certainly the case in the UK. When we look at the UN Convention Against Corruption, so 2003, UN Convention Against Corruption published, I believe 2006 was UK signatory support for that convention, and it was only in 2011 that we had a compliant piece of legislation for the UN Convention Against Corruption. A big piece of work that the Transparency International Network drove was consistent reporting on compliance with the UN Convention Against Corruption. It still goes on since 10th year, called the Exporting Corruption Report. What we've seen there is in some countries actually reducing compliance with UN Convention Against Corruption, particularly when measured against in-practice indicators and effectiveness indicators. And I think the differences between FATF standard and the UN Convention Against Corruption are worth exploring, particularly this issue of expulsion. So clearly with FATF, and you point out one of your criteria, the sanctions around FATF are taken seriously, and expulsion is certainly something that has economic potential effect against the nation. No such similar issue with UN Convention Against Corruption. And therefore we've seen a potentially an effect there, taking that factor as something of a control. Certainly buy-in to FATF has been tremendous, and you point to the drive by the US authorities and the link to their efforts against terrorism and the war on terror having escalated post 9/11. Really having put a huge amount of institutional weight behind the FATF recommendations in law. Again, I'll point to the issue around credibility. I think the embarrassment factor is and the shame at a policy level only bites when there's widespread consensus in the credibility of the standard. And when there's any doubts about the effectiveness of the standard, that immediately provides an opportunity to escape shame. You can blame the standard instead of your own performance. I think we're in a space where historically the FATF has been relatively unchallenged in terms of effectiveness of compliance with FATF recommendations. Does compliance with FATF recommendations result in effective outcomes against terrorist finance and the proceeds of corruption? And other proceeds of crime. That is a question that hasn't really been grappled with. Certainly we've seen evidence of widespread shortcomings in the UK. We've recently had the Public Accounts Committee publish that only 23 pence in every £100 is recovered from the proceeds of crime. The UN Office for Drugs and Crime estimate is that 0.2% of global proceeds of illicit finance are ever seized, with 1% detected. So 99% failure rate to detect is the UN Office for Drugs and Crime estimate. The anti-money laundering system, which is driven by FATF compliance, driven by huge support for this institution, is a very costly framework. The Economist, when they did their last estimate, place it at around $5 billion worth of cost of compliance for Western Europe. That's slightly old as an estimate, and certainly compliance costs from perception surveys, as indicated from AML professionals, indicate that that's gone up dramatically. So we're talking about a very costly system where the evidence of effectiveness is relatively low. So we are in a shift towards effectiveness. FATF's review for the UK for 2016 is highly emphasises effectiveness, and therefore I think we're in this interesting period for the standard whereby recipients have to demonstrate effectiveness. There's a challenge for what effective metrics exist for measuring the effectiveness of AML, And there's certainly some possibility that the effectiveness of the compliance for the standard itself could be brought into question. That could degrade the overall shame effect of having a poor score against this compliance framework. In terms of self-image, so you talked about self-perceptions of esteem and self-image and the result of shame and how that might affect policy decisions. I think it's also important to recognise the link between public recognition of failure to comply with a slope towards sanctions. So particularly the US has been assertive on sanctions which jurisdictions which it felt were performing badly in complying against a regime which it felt was supporting the anti-terrorist financing framework. We've seen in the Crown Dependencies that when there's been public shame on tax issues, that France has taken action against the Crown Dependencies independently. So there's a sometimes quite a short jump between public declarations that may shame and painful sanctions. So it may not just be the shame, but it may be some recognition of sanctions to come. I think in terms of other issues which may be worth considering from a research point of view, it would be good to beyond perceptions and interviews with officials, perhaps it's possible to measure incidents of shame, if you like, whether that's a public report in FATF or elsewhere, and measure the commentary based on that shame incident, whether it's a poor performance in a FATF report. That could be considered in media reporting or in comments in a legislature, and eventually the timeline for a policy decision which may or may not be attributed by the policymaker, the minister concerned, to that performance. It would be good to consider different standards and some kind of explanation as to where and why different standards have been most effective in achieving shame. For instance, various environmental standards have tried to achieve, or dream of achieving the shame that FATF can inflict, but have so far been unsuccessful. And what institutional weight, what events have led to the institutional support for FATF as a standard, and particularly around the financial crisis and the G20 response to the financial crisis, placed a huge amount of onus on FATF, which is a relatively small body of experts, relatively, although it's open to consultation and has a robust consultation process as a body, not accountable to any particular electorate or national authority in a direct sense. So this growth of credibility, where did it come from and why is it so powerful? Those are some thoughts for discussion.
Great, thanks very much, Shane, for raising those issues. Carlton, would you like to sort of respond for a couple of minutes and then we will sort of open up the floor? I wonder if I might just abuse my position to just pick up on one of the things that Nick said around the public reaction being important in the Swiss example. And it just sort of raised in my mind, at what level do we think that the shame is working? So when you talked about it, it was sort of the emotional reactions of individual bureaucrats, really, mm-hmm. who were involved in implementing this. Whereas in a way, the public reaction having an impact is much more about a government needing to respond to a public demand. What's the mechanism between the two of those?
I think that, well, it depends obviously on the specific case and on the country, but when you look at issues of shame or image, obviously there is a problem of attribution, if you want, because I'm talking about a country being shamed. Obviously, you know, a country in itself is not shamed, a country is not socialized, a country doesn't do anything specifically. So the way I looked at it, but I realized that it might depend also on how salient the issue is with specific respect to the country, and Switzerland would be an interesting specific case. And I guess Italy would be for the population if you apply to organized crime, because we might end up being very sensitive to a specific issue. The way I look at it is having different officials from different departments and seeing whether there was some sort of consistency in the kind of replies that they gave me, why this was important, why it was important to score in a certain way, why it was important to comply, and so on and so forth. If there is some sort of repetition, you know, in the findings, and there is some sort of, if you want, congruence and continuity, then you can say that, in a sense, the shame is working at the bureaucratic level. Now, how do you move from that to the actual decision-making level? Because obviously, take the case of Italy in 2007, they needed, obviously, you know, parliamentary action to pass a law. I think that when there is, I mean, the impression that I had is that specifically, for example, with respect to the FATF, it's a very consensual issue where it's bipartisan, for example, support for, having a good scores on FATF's recommendations, and that in a certain sense there is a sort of leverage from, in the specific case, the finance minister with respect to government authorities. But I could not say that this is the case necessarily for every single country, because in that specific case you would go into the specific situation of each single country and what kind of, if you want, once again speaking in additional matters, what kind of identity variables they're very sensitive to. So for example, in Italy, there is a very strong orientation of Italian security and foreign policy with respect to multilateral norms. So we tend to actually describe it, identifying ourselves with the United Nations and, you know, the European Union and other institutions. Let's don't mention the, you know, fringe parties. But in the United States, obviously, the relationship is slightly different. But on the other hand, there is very much the sense of ownership of the process because it was spearheaded by them. And so there is, in a sense, and I think what you were saying in terms of the system being very costly is very interesting, because if they're still implementing it and it is very costly and maybe the effectiveness is not proven up to a certain extent, because obviously after 2012 they're trying to switch it, and, you know, switch it towards a more effectiveness-focused system, but beforehand it was very much the usual implementation with metrics and do we tick the box or do we not tick the box, then it's interesting that countries will go after it even if there is no proven effectiveness and the system is very costly. Because this is one of the classic cases in which you have a dilemma. Why would you do something that is costly, that doesn't prove effectiveness? Why would you keep on doing it? So I think, to answer your question, it really depends on the specific country and what specific identity, if you want, variables they're sensitive to. And so I guess in the case of Switzerland, that has some resonance. In the case of Italy, it would have some resonance if it became a problem that shamed the country with respect, for example, to organized crime. Then I think that could, for example, arise certain type of reactions in the public. For example, you mentioned the Anti-Corruption Convention. I think it's the Palermo Convention. Palermo is in Italy, obviously. It was signed, I think, in Italy. It took us 6 years to implement it. I think I was working at the time, actually, the Italian Foreign Ministry Counterterrorism Directorate. And we were profoundly ashamed because obviously the name of the convention was an Italian convention. We were expecting a visit from the representatives of the Counterterrorism Committee at the United Nations that they had to verify as a country visit the implementation of Resolution 1373 in Italy. And it's only when that happened that we pushed it through in Parliament and it actually got ratified. So I think that up to a certain extent there is a game that is played between, you know, bureaucracies on the one hand and governments on the other hand, and public opinion. And depending on the country, the issue can be more or less relevant, but there are some certain variables that are particularly sensitive. So I think that obviously I haven't looked in detail in the case of Switzerland, but I imagine that they would be particularly sensitive to that, and maybe certain levers would be sensitive in the case of other countries. I'm not sure.
Okay, questions?